Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And on Free for All Friday, we take a break from theology, apologetics, and usually from current events so we can just focus on random, interesting, eclectic topics that I enjoy talking about. But given recent events, I've decided to postpone by 1 week the Free for All Friday I wanted to air today, and those were my random thoughts on Pixar movies. You know, I wanted to do something just kind of fun and lighthearted, but given everything that's happened recently, I thought it would be good to focus on one element of it. So you see, when I was watching the events unfold in La Mesa, California last week when there was protests which devolved into looting and rioting less than a mile from my home. I mean, police station was attacked, banks were burned down. I went the next day to see the damage and to help clean up, and there were things that were still smoldering. I mean, it was absolutely crazy to see that this would happen. And as I was watching it unfold that night, my family was sleeping, our car was packed in case the riots came into our neighborhood and buildings were set on fire. I mean, I thought there was maybe, I don't know, a 1% chance that would happen, but that's enough to get me to pack our car and be ready to leave in case, you know, bad stuff goes down. So you see, when I'm afraid of something, what I do as a defense mechanism is learn as much as I can about it. So when I was a kid, if I was afraid of some animal, venomous animal, I would read everything about it to know what it was, where it lived, how could I could protect myself from it. If I'm afraid of natural disasters or unrest, I read about it now. I have a disaster plan so that I'm prepared. That's how I handle being afraid of things. Even if I'm afraid of my personal life, being a bad husband or a bad father, I go and I read to see how to be a good husband and good father, and I implement it sometimes, though my better half is better at implementing that in her own life, and she always helps me to be the better man that my family needs me to be. But one thing I feel like I needed to be for my family was the protector, right? I want to make sure they're not assaulted by anyone, not caught in a burning home in a riot. So I was researching riots to see how do these things unfold, how do they start, and then more importantly, how do you stop them? So that's what I want to talk about today here on the Council of Trent podcast on Free for All Friday. So when you read the literature about riots, what's interesting about them is they kind of spread like a fire. There's a lot of language to describe them that is similar to a fire. Like if you think about it, you have a bunch of people and then they start expanding and spreading through a community and they destroy things. And then we use phrases about a riot ending. We say things like it will flame out or it will burn out or it'll run out of steam or it will wither. You know, we talk about it almost like a fire running out of fuel. And that really is how riots end up starting. They need two elements. They need fuel and a spark. So fuel would be the underlying social tensions that create aggravation and agitation in people and make them feel more propelled to want to do something drastic. And it's not always political, by the way. It's not always political. We'll talk about other kinds of riots that are different from social and political riots. So there has to be some kind of fuel that gets people agitated. But then you need a spark. You need something that is different from the underlying fuel that is not like the normal, ordinary course of events. Something unusual has happened and it kicks everyone into kind of a violent mode or a mode where they lose their individual sense of self and go on to become destructive and harmful to others. So I'll give you two examples of that. Both of them happened in Los Angeles. So when I was watching the news, seeing La Mesa, California having a riot, I was like, this is La Mesa, not Los Angeles. They have riots all up there. We don't get riots down here. And on Tuesday, I explained the reason we had that down here was because there was a viral video of a La Mesa police officer pushing an African-American teenager and being rough with him. And so, I mean, it's not brutality like the kind that was involved in the death of George Floyd, but it was definitely something, it was the absolute worst time to have a video like that surface. You had way more people in La Mesa. I mean, I was really amazed how fast it unfolded. You had 25 people on the freeway on-ramp, and then hundreds of people blocking the interstate, and then maybe 1,000 people in downtown La Mesa moving through and looting things. So I was like, well, is there going to be 2,000, 3,000 people? Is a whole neighborhood going to go up? That's happened before in Los Angeles. So consider the Watts riots. So Watts is a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and the fuel for this riot had been building for decades. After World War II, there was something called the Second Great Migration. The first Great Migration took place between 1910 and 1945, when a lot of African Americans left the South because they didn't want to live under Jim Crow laws. You know, this is a place where you could just be lynched for any reason. A mob could just kill you, and there'd be absolutely no justice for you whatsoever. So while they weren't technically slaves, they still did not have the full rights as human beings and citizens that whites had. So a lot of them left to go to places like Chicago and the Midwest and Tulsa, and other, even though Tulsa ended up having the Tulsa Massacre 100 years ago, where Black Wall Street got burned down. So they still left the South to try to find, go to the North and go West to find a better life for themselves. The second great migration happened, although during this time, a lot of African Americans did not end up in Los Angeles or the West Coast. But then after World War II, there was a lot of movement among African Americans into the Los Angeles area. And then there were generational conflicts that arose from things like redlining, where there were a large amount of neighborhoods where African Americans could not buy homes or rent property. And then more and more racist interactions with the Los Angeles Police Department. This came to a head August 11th, 1965. 21-year-old Marquette Fry, an African-American man driving his mother's 1955 Buick, was pulled over by California Highway Patrol motorcycle officer Lee Minicus for alleged reckless driving. After administering a field sobriety test, Minicus placed Fry under arrest and radioed for his vehicle to be impounded. Marquette's brother, Ronald, a passenger in the vehicle, walked to their house nearby, bringing their mother, Rena Price, back with him to the scene of the arrest. When Rena Price reached the intersection of Avalon and 116th Street, she scolded Fry about drinking and driving. But the situation quickly escalated. Someone shoved Price. Fry was struck. Price jumped an officer, and another officer pulled out a shotgun. So there was a scuffle. People were pushed. An officer was pushed. Then this got word back to the community members. It said community members reported that police had roughed up Fry and kicked a pregnant woman. At the report of that news, angry mobs began to form. And then they watched the exchange. There was yelling. There was fighting. After the arrests, Price and her sons, the crowd continued to grow along Avalon Boulevard. Police came to break up the crowd, but were attacked when people threw rocks and chunks of concrete. A 46-square-mile swath of Los Angeles was transformed into a combat zone during the ensuing 6 days. So this was the deadliest and most devastating riot that had ever hit Los Angeles in its history, until it was outdone in 1992. So here you have the fuel, racism, and then you had the spark, which was this interaction and the claim that Los Angeles Police Department had roughed up a man for the crime of quote-unquote driving while black, kicked a pregnant woman, and they'd had enough and started to riot. This was, however, superseded by the LA riots in 1992. This occurred on starting on April 29th, extending into May, after a trial jury acquitted four officers of the LAPD for usage of excessive force in the arrest and beating of Rodney King. And that was shocking to a lot of people. If you remember Rodney King, there's these four officers are hitting him with batons and kicking him. And it seemed clear it's police brutality. But then this jury ended up acquitting them, saying that Rodney King had been resisting arrest. And people just, they absolutely lost it. The rioting spread throughout the LA metropolitan area. Thousands of people rioted over a 6 day period. The disorder was only resolved after the California Army National Guard and the U.S. military and federal law enforcement intervened. By the time the riots ended, 63 people had been killed. Over 2,300 people were injured. 12,000 people had been arrested. And there was $1 billion in damages. There's actually a really neat video talking about this. It was reflections on it by members of a barbershop where the riots first broke out in Los Angeles. And the owners of this black barbershop were reflecting on what happened.
Yeah, I said, well, the flashpoint was anywhere in Los Angeles.
At LT's barbershop, you get a haircut along with a discussion.
It couldn't happen today.
No? Why not?
The police today are not the same force it was back then.
I disagree with him. It could happen again. If they can riot when the Lakers win, they can riot for a bad verdict.
To me, it's not better. It's about the same.
This is what you call friendly conversation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to disagree. Yeah.
You got a white cop with attitude, and I don't care what kind of policies are in effect, it's going to come out.
So this interview was actually recorded. It was 25 years later after the riots. So they're interviewing these men who were present when it happened. And their observations are very prescient, because now we're seeing these riots and looting that was happening in L.A. dealing with George Floyd. I actually had some people here at the office, some of the younger set, the younger whippersnappers, asking me, you know, oh man, do you think, is this like Rodney King? I'm like, oh, it was nothing like that, even though I was like 7 years old at the time. But I remember watching TV. I remember watching the TV because I lived in San Diego. I lived not that far away. I lived in Encinitas, California. I remember they were showing the footage of Reginald Denny, who was the truck driver, driving through Los Angeles area while the riots were happening, and people pulled him out of his truck and assaulted him and nearly beat him to death, which prompted, then they interviewed Rodney King, who, you know, it was the verdict in the Rodney King trial that brought all of this about, and then he uttered this very famous soundbite that people have kind of made fun of since then. Can't we all just get along? But, you know, it was very serious what he was saying at the time.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids?
And so, I mean, you can hear in his voice just the emotions, one of just processing everything that's happening and knowing that his name is tied into this. Obviously, he didn't do anything wrong to have his name tied into this, but to be at the center of this and see all this violence and destruction, when that's not what he wanted. When he went to trial for what happened to him at the hands of those police officers, he wanted justice. And what was happening in those riots then, just as what was happening with looting and destruction now, it was not justice for George Floyd, and it wasn't justice for Rodney King at that time. Now, not all riots are political in nature. A very common subset of riots are sports riots. Probably the earliest sports riot ever recorded were the Nika riots in Constantinople on January 13th, 532. So 532 AD, 500 years after the crucifixion, Emperor Justinian was at a chariot race at a hippodrome, and there was a crowd there. Now, a lot of the chariot races were also political. There were political factions that were backing different charioteers. So people would shout like blue or green. Obviously, they didn't shout the English words, but they were shouting the colors based on the political faction they favored in that particular race, until the crowd started chanting Nika, Nika, which means win or victory or conquer. And then finally, the crowd just burst into a frenzy. So it was a mixture half political, though half sports riot. It took place at a chariot race in the Hippodrome. So that's the earliest sports riot in 532. A recent one that was a very deadly sports riot took place in Port Said, Egypt. This is the Port Said riot. On February 1st, 2012, at Port Said Stadium, there was an Egyptian Premier League football match, soccer for all you Americans, between Masri and Ali. And it said 74 people were killed and more than 500 were injured after thousands of Masri spectators stormed the stadium stands following a 3-1 victory by their team and violently attacked Ali fans using clubs, stones, bottles, and fireworks, getting them all trapped in the El Ali partition of the stadium. Many of the deaths were due to the police's refusal to open the stadium gates, trapping the Ali fans inside, leaving some to die, killing others in a stampede to escape. Another riot that took place here in North America in a very unexpected place, it was a sports riot, were the 2011 Stanley Cup riots in Vancouver. And so this was after Vancouver lost to the Boston Bruins at the 2011 Stanley Cup. And normally you think of Canadians as being very polite people. And so when you watch the news stories, look up 2011 Vancouver riots, you see them breaking windows, beating people, throwing rocks at police. I'm like, hey, who boot that? You Canadians shouldn't have this kind of drama. That's not what you do, eh? You know, I'm like, what is going on here? So here's a clip, actually, of some people who were involved in that particular riot talking about what happened.
So we were having to ferry people from one side of that building through the other. And I happened to see a woman who had somehow in the night been cut quite badly in the head, and she was bleeding quite severely. So they were trying to give her first aid while they moved her through the building. So that was the first indication that maybe the evening wasn't going to go very well.
I hit that decline just before Boundary Road, where you can see the cityscape in front of you. And there's three separate columns of smoke coming from the downtown core. And I think not even knowing what I was going to see when I got there, just that unknown, it made it all that much more real for me and more poignant.
So that was actually a member of the Vancouver law enforcement describing how he's driving into the city, getting ready to confront this riot, seeing the smoke rising in his city. Imagine that, putting a little pit in your stomach, knowing you're going to go and confront rioters in this way. So, okay, so we've talked a little bit about how riots start and what is involved in them, the fuel and the spark. And so the way to put them out is you have to put them out like you put out a fire. You have to use specific tactics and specific gear. So one thing, if you look online, especially if you saw riot patrol, riot control brigades, who are now usually more called crowd control. They don't like to call themselves riot police. They're crowd control police. Their goal is to have people be in a crowd and to control it so that they're peacefully assembling or that they are dispersing in order to prevent damage to life and property. But in order to do that, they have to make a show of force. And one way to do that is they have to intimidate people. They don't want people to engage in lawless action. So they want to show these people that they are a threat, that if you choose to engage in unlawful behavior, we are a threat and we have power to be able to stop you. And they use different tools and techniques and psychological tactics to be able to accomplish that. One thing is just the way that they dress. They dress in identical gear. They use dark colored armor. Reminds me of the stormtroopers from Star Wars, but they're not wearing white. They wear black or gray. They have helmets. They have shields. And they all look similar. And so they look like a large, imposing mass. And that puts fear in others to seem that, like, if you go and try to attack one officer, you don't feel like you're attacking just one person. You feel like you're attacking a large conglomerate of 25 or 50 or 100 people, and that makes you feel like you don't really want to do that. They also act in unison. It's not like they're all scattered about like a checkered board. They'll stand in a line or in a very particular formation so that they can appear formidable to people. Now, rioters will often do the same thing, but they're usually not as disciplined. Rioters will sometimes dress in the same colors. They'll bunch together as well, but usually they don't have a plan. They'll scatter and they'll move about in kind of a more random way, whereas crowd control, or I'll call them riot control because it's just simpler, they respond in a specific way that they have trained to be able to do that. So they'll use particular weapons. They'll have shields, for example. The shields can be made to be bulletproof, but they usually are not because that'd be very heavy for them to walk around with. Instead, the shields are made out of a plexiglass that's meant to keep away shards of metal or glass or rocks that are thrown at them or sparks from incendiary devices. They'll carry a 24 to 42 inch baton to be able to disable someone. They'll have pepper spray. Pepper spray is something that can often be very effective. What you want to do in these situations, that they only want to hurt someone to the point where that person regains their individuality. So the reason these riots happen is because you get lost in the mob. You feel like you're really powerful because you're with a bunch of other, 100 other people. You feel anonymous. It's like they don't know it's you, and you feel like you can get away with stuff, and you think you're just a parter subset of the aggregate. You're just an appendage of this rioting mob, and you think you can get away with whatever you want because you feel bigger than you really are, until somebody smacks you with a baton or you get pepper spray in the eye and you fall down, you're clutching your eyes and you can't see, and you suddenly realize you're weak and helpless because you can't see, and then that's the work of what the pepper spray is getting to you. Which, by the way, Free For All Friday fans, how hot is military-grade issued pepper spray? How spicy is it, I should say? 1.5 million Scoville units. So if you want to go back a few weeks ago, I did an episode on pain scales. I did one on the Scoville pain units. And there's actually peppers out there that are spicier than police-issued pepper spray that they would use to control riots. So they use pepper spray to do that, though a lot of people who engage in riots professionally, like these Antifa people, they have countermeasures to try to stop police from using these tools. So for example, they'll carry milk with them. They'll pour milk in their eyes to get rid of the spiciness of the pepper spray. Because think about this, if you eat spicy food, how do you get rid of the spice in your mouth? Like if your mouth feels really hot, you don't want water that spreads the fire in your mouth, right? You'll eat bread or you'll eat milk because milk is slightly basic. And so it counteracts the acidity, a little bit of the spice. So you'll see people in protests sometimes when pepper spray is used, they'll pour milk in their eyes to try to counteract it. Also, officers are trained to withstand pepper spray. So sometimes if people have their own pepper spray or it blows back in your face, you don't want to be crying on the ground. So officers are trained. Here's a clip actually of Marines, because Marines, when they're on patrol in foreign countries, sometimes they have to deal with civilians who are rioting and they want to engage them in a peaceful way. And so what they will do in this scene, they pepper spray a guy and they tell him, how many fingers do I have? 2 fingers, to show he can still see. And then he has to go and he has to mock fight people and subdue them while he has pepper spray in his eyes. So listen carefully. You can hear him scream in pain as he's trying to carry out his job to subdue these mock rioters in a training while being sprayed with real pepper spray.
You got it, come on, man. Think through it. What does he got to do? Look left, look right.
Look left, look left. Jump back.
Strike, strike. Strike, strike. There you go. Strike, strike. Strike, strike. Take one down. There you go.
Get down.
Get
down.
Get ready. Here comes the next. Strike him. Strike him. All right.
I feel bad. I don't want to laugh, but you hear him. Like, so he's got these big guys coming after him in padded gear, and he's got to fight them. But you hear him in the background going, They go through this kind of training. They go through it to be able to handle. They got to train hard because these kind of things can happen. You don't want to be defenseless in the middle of a mob because bad things can happen. They also use CS gas, which is the compound 2-chlorobenzyl maldonitrile. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Cyanocarbon, which is a defining component of tear gas, commonly called CS gas. CS gas will be used. It causes a burning sensation, tearing of the eyes. You can't keep your eyes open, burning irritation of the nose, mouth, and throat, disorientation, and difficulty breathing, oftentimes partially incapacitating the subject. If you recall, I'm always doing throwbacks to previous episodes. Our episode with Jimmy Akin, where we talked about Waco, this stuff is really serious, and it was used at Waco indoors on women and children. And like when it's outdoors and you smell that stuff, it can bring a soldier down to his knees. It's powerful stuff. And they were using it in the George Floyd protests to get people to disperse from an area. If they're not going to leave, they throw the gas out. Now, at Waco, it was bad. They used the gas indoors where people could be asphyxiated. They're only supposed to use it like with the Floyd protests and others. You do it outdoors where just people flee. It's open air. They're uncomfortable and they want to get out of that situation. Other weapons that will be used to try to disperse crowds include rubber bullets that are skipped off the pavement. These are less than lethal weapons. They're not non-lethal. A rubber bullet can kill you if it is fired at point-blank range. Usually, though, it's skipped off the pavement, so it'll leave a really bad welt or bruise and make you think twice and recover your individuality and your sense of fear and make you want to leave the situation. The goal here, the goal in crowd control and riot control is not to defeat the rioters. This is not war. And there have been previous attempts of engaging crowds, we'll talk about them here in a few moments, where the riot control officers treated it as like a war. It's us versus those rioters. It's us versus those punk liberal hippies and trying to bring them into submission. That's not the goal. The goal is not to defeat the enemy. The goal is just to get people to leave. That is the goal in any riot control operation, is you want to show through some kind of intervention, oftentimes intimidation, or the use of force, that you just want to get people to leave the scene. And if they can leave peacefully, that's the most ideal. But if you have to use force, you only use the least amount of force possible to get people to leave the scene. So other things that are used are chemical paintballs to deliver pepper, like delivering pepper spray rounds to someone who's too far away to be able to spray them. Animals are sometimes used, like dogs or horses. They're actually not as affected by CS gas, so they can be effective to move people, especially horses are big and imposing, and people naturally want to get out of the way of them. Dye rounds are another tool that's used. Some people will be shot with dye rounds and it tags them as, you know, a looter or something. And then police can just go and arrest them later because they know that they're covered in purple paint or something like that. They have reason to believe they were involved in not just peacefully protesting, but looting or violence against officers. And people have been experimenting with different kinds of weapons to be able to accomplish the goal of dispersing others in a peaceful way that is less than lethal, that causes the least amount of harm to others. They've experimented with infrasound, which is where, you know, you fire low frequency sound waves at people and it makes their stomach sick, almost to the point of nausea. But that could have unintended health consequences. Hasn't been researched enough to see if it is effective. They've experimented using nets, which I think would be hilarious to watch in a riot, to see somebody, you would fire a net at someone and it would wrap around them and they would be immobilized. Gooey foam is another one, like foam that would like immobilize someone, like spray it at their feet and they won't be able to move, or they can only move slowly. That to me seems like a horrible idea, because if it attaches and then quickly solidifies, like what if that gets in someone's nostrils or covers somebody's mouth? Like that to me could get lethal pretty quickly, but they're experimenting with it to see what they can come up with. So they try to intimidate people and they have these gears, weapons. They also have a particular kind of tactic that they use to get people to disperse. There will be a front line of riot control officers marching towards supports people. Behind them will be another line supporting them. Then there will be a team leader who will be giving cues and directions and commands. The team leader will have two people next to him, usually gas officers who can fire the CS gas and other ordnance to drive people away. And then behind them, they have another duplicate line to the front line called the rear line, and that is to protect them in case they get flanked by rioters on their other side, or they can move and switch out the front line in case the front line becomes fatigued. And the goal with the line is they will send them in. Usually it's to move people in a certain direction. The line also is not impenetrable. It can be spaced so that peaceful protesters or people who want to leave can pass through. But if there is someone who is an agitator, usually riot control officers will not try to arrest every single person who is rioting. They don't have the resources to do that. In order to intimidate a crowd that has become violent, they will target the most violent people, or they will target the leaders, people who seem to be directing others. And so they will go and target those people, and the line will then encircle around those people in order, and then, there's another line of people called the arresting officers. You have the front line. You have the backup line, or the arresting officers are usually there. You have the team leader and the gas officers next to him. And the fourth or fifth line is the rear echelon, or the rear line. And they'll always leave an escape route. It's a mistake in riot control to try to pin people down in an area and trap them and quote unquote defeat them. You're just going to get people hurt or killed and prolong the hostilities when you don't need to. Remember, it's like a fire. The goal is just to get them to disperse and flame out. So if you can target it central where the hotspot is and arrest the biggest troublemakers, hopefully everyone else will leave, or they will disperse, or can be handled by other law enforcement that aren't specialized in riot gear. Because if you just have three or four people that break off from the main group, a regular police officer or patrol unit could be able to handle people like that. So one example of riot control where things got out of hand, where there was this us versus them mentality without a clear idea of how to defuse the threat that was in front of them, would be the Kent State shootings, also known as the May 4th massacre or the Kent State massacre. These were the shootings of 13 unarmed Kent State University students in Kent, Ohio, by the Ohio National Guard on May 4th, 1970. The killings took place during a peace rally against the expanding involvement of the Vietnam War into neutral Cambodia, as well as the presence of National Guard on campus. The incident marked the first time that a student has been slain in an anti-war gathering in United States history. 28 National Guard soldiers fired 67 rounds over a period of 13 seconds, killing four students and wounding nine others. Here is some actual news footage and reports from the day in question from what happened.
A few kids were throwing sticks and stones, but that was only a handful, not more than 10, 15. And then the guard shot some tear gas up on the hill to disperse the crowd, and the kids picked it up and threw it back.
This area immediately. Leave this area immediately.
And all of a sudden I heard the shooting. And then I saw people dropping to the ground, and then I fell to the ground also, because I couldn't walk anymore.
What the investigators have to determine then is whether indeed there was a sniper, and whether the guard was justified in firing its weapons, or whether, as some people here believe, the guard, under the pressure of a rock-throwing attack, panicked and fired its weapons indiscriminately, killing four people.
The allegation that a sniper fired on the National Guardsmen, which was what prompted them to fire into the crowd, has never been substantiated. But the President's Commission on Campus Unrest that was formed shortly after the incident said, "The indiscriminate firing of rifles into a crowd of students and the deaths that followed were unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable." And then after the shooting, there was still panic. There were still students who wanted to fight the National Guard and continue protesting. And thankfully, it was diffused not by the guardsmen, not by those involved with riot control, but professors, actually the ones who had to come forward and diffused these students and diffused the crowd. So here's a recording of one of those professors involved that day and what he said to the students.
"I don't care whether you've never listened to anyone before in your lives. I am begging you right now, if you don't disperse right now, they're going to move in and it can only be a slaughter. Would you please listen to me? Jesus Christ, I don't want to be a part of this."
Von Frank was begging us to leave. And he was crying. And I had never seen a man cry before. So we did. And we picked these directions that, that if the guards started shooting again, somebody would be alive to tell the story.
So as you can see, that's the ultimate goal when you're dealing with a crowd that is volatile, that could become violent, is to disperse that crowd, is to disperse them, diffuse the situation. Sometimes the crowd becomes violent and you have to respond with force, but you try to use the least amount of force possible and you're targeted and surgical in your response so that you can bring the hostilities down in an efficient way. I want to end with two video clips I think are interesting related to dealing with riots. One comes from the Rodney King riots and the other one comes from the recent riots related to the death of George Floyd. This one is following John Bell. He is a Los Angeles police officer, and this is when he was on patrol during the riots. So what was happening here is you don't have just a single group of people. You have an entire city that has kind of descended into lawlessness, and now officers, in many cases, have to go on patrol and deal with looting and other elements like this. Sometimes they're on their own. They call in backup if there's a lot of people, but if it's just one or two or a handful of people, they have to go and deal with it themselves before they call backup. But what I like about John Bell in this clip is that he's not an irrational authoritarian, but he's also tough when he needs to be to deal with criminals. As you see in this clip, it includes criminals who were looting a convenience store, tore it apart, trying to get snacks. And he has to be tough with them and firm, but he's not irrational or abusive in the way that he handles that. So let me play some of that clip. I really like this guy. And the way to describe how he looks, if you ever saw the grandfather on Arrested Development, the patriarch of the Arrested Development family, he looks a little bit like him, but I really like the guy. Oh, and there is a mild language warning I will give to you here, just a mild language warning.
And all these little businessmen right now, they're being raped by these idiots. What's your gun? Come out here. Come on.
So now he is arresting three teenagers who tore a store apart. They tore apart a convenience store and were looting.
You almost got your ass blown away. You understand that? You ever, ever stick your hand up underneath your shirt and pull out a screwdriver? It looks like a gun to me. You almost died because you wanted some Twinkies, you jerk. You know, if you're gonna take food, if you're going to break into a place because you're hungry and that's what you do, then that's what you do. But just come in here and trash the place, dump everything on the ground, doesn't make much sense to me.
Well, I'm sorry, but I've been busy. It's been crazy out here. There's been several shootings here, but I haven't been involved in any. Well, I should be home maybe day after tomorrow, hopefully. All right, love you. Take care. I got to go. Bye.
So that's him calling his wife after all of that to let her know he's okay, because this is 1992. You don't have cell phones. So he goes to a payphone and calls his wife to let him know that he's all right. And you heard him with those kids. Like, he's tough and firm. He's like, you little jerks, you could have gotten shot for trying to steal a Twinkie. Don't do that. So I appreciate that you can have that attitude. You can be fair and firm and even loving. That it's what we mean by tough love. You will the good for another. And the good for another is that they don't get shot, especially for some kind of a petty and trivial reason to be involved in violence. So that's one element there, that you have to be fair and firm when you are dealing with people, especially those who are breaking the law. So that's the attitude you have when you have someone who is looting, someone who is breaking the law, has a disregard for other people's safety and property. Then you have to have this tough, firm, but fair attitude when dealing with them. However, you don't want to have that attitude with people who are just peacefully protesting. So some protests devolve into riots because the officers take an aggressive attitude when they don't need to. So actually, one of the best examples of how to defuse a riot or to keep it from ever happening is to be humble and joyful and really empathize with those who are rioting and not have a, it's me versus them and I hate these darn hippies. That you have to do things where I'm going to empathize with them, not going to condone illegal or dangerous behavior, but I'm going to empathize with their lawful actions. And that's what we saw in Flint, Michigan, actually. I'm going to end with this clip of the sheriff of Flint, Michigan, speaking with the protesters there in a beautiful way that diffused tensions to avoid any kind of riot. So here's what he said to them.
The only reason we're here is to make sure that you got a voice. That's it.
There we go.
Don't think for a second. Don't think for a second that he represents who these cops are from all over the county and around this nation. We go out there to help people, not do that nonsense.
There we go.
I just want to tell you, we want to be with y'all for real. So I took my helmet off and laid the batons down. I want to make this a parade, not a protest. You got little ones here, you got dogs, so what's up? So listen, I'm just telling you, these cops love you. That cop over there hugs people, so you tell us what you need to do.
And you see, that's beautiful, because that's what we can do. And there's a lot of people in this situation who would have pride, and they would think to themselves, there are people in this crowd who irrationally hate law enforcement, so I irrationally hate them. Or maybe you might have a justified anger towards someone who wishes harm upon law enforcement. That would be justified to have that anger, but it takes a special kind of grace. It takes that special kind of grace, and that's why I pray to God to always have that grace with the people we interact with, to say, I'm going to put aside my pride, I'm going to look at this other person, even if I disagree with him or her, as a child of God, and empathize with them where they're coming from, and if they are being peaceful, even if I may disagree with them, if I'm law enforcement, I want to facilitate their ability, because law enforcement, it should be neutral, right? Whatever someone's marching for, if they're exercising their First Amendment rights, whatever their point of view is, it's the job of law enforcement to protect them. And so if law enforcement can encourage them, if you want to march, if you want to have your message be heard, we're here. And he can agree with that. If the message is just police officers ought not practice brutality, well, every single officer in this country should agree with that and could march towards that. And we ought to march towards that, towards protecting the dignity and the lives of every single human being. So I hope this is a helpful free-for-all Friday for you guys. Stay safe out there. Definitely consider, if you feel called to it, exercise your First Amendment rights to peacefully assemble when it's justified to do so. I mean, I love being able to do that every year when I can at the March for Life, for example. But we should always take care that when we exercise our rights, to do so in a dignified way, in a lawful way, in a way that is just and respectful of our fellow human beings. And so I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the law enforcement, including all the law enforcement over the years that have protected my First Amendment rights to be able to speak on university campuses and peacefully assemble. So I'm thankful for all of those men and women who have kept me safe, kept you safe. Pray for them and everything that they do, and I hope that you all just have a really blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.